We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly interview show where top chess players, authors, content creators, and accomplished amateurs discuss their careers and share stories and chess improvement tips. Perpetual Chess is a part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network, and we'd like to give special thanks to our presenting chess education sponsor, Chessable.com. For more information about the show, you can go to PerpetualChessPod.com. But without further ado, let's get to the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We have a fun pod coming your way with returning guest, adult improver extraordinaire Neil Bruce, talking about how to study the legends, master games, in particular game compilation books. Neil has been plowing through them, and he joins us to share which he found the most noteworthy and for us to discuss whether we think this is a good way to a good thing to incorporate into your study routine. I also wanted to let you guys know that I found out after I recorded the pod that I have COVID. I'm telling you this not to get some outpouring of sympathy from you all, but just to let you know that I'm actually going to take the next week off from Perpetual Chess. So this episode will be out on November 8th, and then we will be back on November 22nd. So just wanted to let you all know that. But without further ado, let's get you to the podcast talking game compilation books with Neil Bruce.
Hello and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. This is Neil Bruce. I'm here with your host, Ben Johnson. Ben, take it away.
Hello, everyone. Great to be back here with Neil Bruce. I think regular listeners are familiar with Neil, nicknamed by me the Habit Grandmaster. In addition to a busy job and a family, he puts in tons of time studying chess with his famed self-generated flashcards and currently is working on game collections. So the topic of this book-focused podcast will be game collections. Listeners, you may hear my voice is a little hoarse. We are recording this on Wednesday, November 2nd. I had a late night at the World Series game last night, and it's some combination of that and me getting sick, so I apologize, but we're powering through. We're good to go, and Neil is always a pro and well-prepared, so I feel that we are in good hands. So Neil, game collections. Could you explain sort of give a little context for newer listeners and discuss how it is that you decided to study a bunch of game collection books, which we will be looking to share some insights about how worthwhile they are. And I'll also be discussing some of the books I've reviewed previously on the podcast. Anyway, Neil, game collections.
Yeah, so let me start by giving a little context about myself, particularly for newer listeners, and set that context with game collections as a subset. And then we're going to talk a little bit about what to expect and how to do study or our thoughts on studying game collections. And we'll talk about some specifics of some of the books that we've been going through. But I'm on kind of a 10, might be an 11 year quest to get better at chess. I started with tactics. I spent about 4 years on tactics, and now about three, might turn into 3.5 years on strategy. It actually happens that I started my strategy work just as COVID was sending people home, when I started working from home in April of 2020. And that plan was first general strategy books, and then pawn books, and then puzzle books. I chopped up about 1,700 positional puzzles, put them into as flashcards into boxes that I go through a few every day. And now I'm on to game collections. And what's interesting is there were roughly the same number of games, because I keep track of every game I play through on my board as I'm going through these books, about the same number of games in the general strategy books as in these game collections, because I read so many of them. So give you a sense of totals. I've done about 1,750 games. So I've played through that many since I started in 2020. I've got about 800 or so to go. So I'll finish maybe middle of next year. And that'll be, you know, roughly 2,500, 2,600 total games that I will play through. Some would be formal game collections. Some would be things like Reassess Your Chess. The fourth edition has 187 games. So some of these books are really, you know, I've joked before that game collections are strategy books are very similar, but strategy books are just game collections by theme. So you can see, as I look at my list, I track all this stuff in a spreadsheet, that lots of these game these strategy books that we've talked about in the past are actually like hidden game collections. So yeah, that's a little bit of background. You started with game collections when you were a kid, so maybe you could give a little background for yourself too, Ben.
Sure. Yeah. I was thinking back, you know, again, regular listeners will know that I made most of my chess improvements in my teens when I was playing competitively with a pretty strong team. And I also studied on my own, although I think honestly playing in game review probably were the biggest contributors to my success. But I love chess and I wanted to study. You know, some things never change. So in those days, you know, we're talking circa 1990. I'm an old man. So game collections, a lot of the books that get recommended every week here, particularly by older guests, are game collections. There's a lot that have stood the test of time, from Fisher's My 60 Memorable Games to Zurich 1953. By the way, I've done podcasts on both of those. As Neil will be discussing today, it's a lot of his are focused on like individual players doing sort of their memoir game collections, which is a tried and true genre that I often enjoy. So I think a common theme as we start to explore this will be who knows how much it helps your chess. You know, it's really hard to say. All we can say is there are people who've gotten really good at chess who used game collections as an extensive part of their improvement regimen. But of course, there are also people that haven't. So, but to me, even today, as we got ready for this podcast, I pulled up some games by Alexander Aliekhine, or Alekhine, if you prefer. And that's one of the books Neil will be discussing. And I was just remembering how fun it is to just play through games. So to me, that's part of the appeal, how helpful it is, how much time you should spend. We got a bunch of Twitter questions, and we'll be addressing that to the extent we can over time. But I mean, you know, one of my bottom lines is we don't really know, but we will try to answer it. And meanwhile, I just think one of the top lines has to be that it's fun to learn that way, at least for me.
For sure. So I'll build on that, on the kind of why annotated games. I'll start by saying, as a, you know, relatively well-educated adult, people have made attempts at helping adults get better at chess, but I will emphasize the word attempts, that like there is no clear formula. I know that the Chess Dojo's working on a program, and others have had programs, but I'm kind of making this up as I go. And I've heard Dan Heisman and others talk about the importance of playing through games. I'll talk a little bit about what benefits I've seen, practical benefits in my games in a few minutes. But, you know, the why for me has to do with things that Ben, you and I talked about before the podcast, which is one of the problems that can come from breaking, compartmentalizing chess is you don't really get a sense of the flow of a full game. If you think about tactics separately from strategy, separately from end game, separately from openings, it can all feel very compartmentalized and hard to feel a sense of flow. So I think a sense of flow, I have noticed a few of the games that I've studied of the 1700 are actually my opening. And so like sometimes I'll see ideas and openings that I hadn't seen before. So that's a reason to study game collections. Pawn structures, you know, it's one thing to study books about pawn structures, another thing to see them in action. So I look at game collections as kind of the capstone of my strategy work. And also things like how to win a one game. Like a lot of the times game, in kind of general chess improvement books, it'll say, and then the rest was a matter of technique. And for someone at my level around 1700, it's not a matter of technique. I need to see the answer. Right. And so like, it's really useful to see how people actually won games. So every one I counted, I've studied thousands of fragments. I'm only counting the full games in my 1750. Like that's where I really see when the winning side forces the other side to either capitulate or to be checkmated. And you want to see a full game because in real life, you play a full game. Anything else? You know, I know in the past you talked about chess culture. What are some of the other whys for you, Ben?
Well, you hit on a big one there. As I mentioned, I was just to get in the mood playing through some Aryekin games today, and one of them was one of his more famous wins against Capablanca from 1927. I'm sure it's in one of the Aliekhine books you read, Neil, although it may or may not have left an imprint. But it reaches an endgame where he's up a pawn and he's trying to convert it. And there are a few spots where he kind of goes in one direction and then backtracks and then goes in one direction and then backtracks. So here you have this world champion that kind of had to figure out how to win the position over the board. And if you're just doing tactics, that's something that you don't see. But when you go to play, you encounter that feeling all the time where you're like, all right, you know, I'm probably winning, but I'm not exactly sure what to do here. And of course, in endgames, you know, as I talked about when, excuse me, Kevin Skull and I did the endgame strategy, you know, one of Shereshevsky's precepts from the book Endgame Strategy is do not rush. And you see this precept in action. So that's another thing. I mean, obviously studying games, and it's a good way to learn chess history. So you can at least have the knowledge that, look, this might be helping me, this might not be helping me, but at least now when someone names a world champion, I'll be able to associate a playing style. If you go through, say, I know Karpov's games was one of the books you went through. So there's lots of good reasons. Again, we don't know for sure how much it helps. And, you know, one interesting issue we've talked about before, Neil, is it's hard to isolate the variables in chess. So, you know, you've gone through all these games, amazing work ethic. I'm sure you feel like you've learned a lot, and maybe you'd even show some rating gains, but it's not like that's the only thing you're doing, right? So a lot of it's like why it's notoriously hard to do like a nutritional study, because you just can't take one thing in isolation. So I think that's part of the reason that we just don't know for sure, but I certainly like, and I know a lot of like longtime chess fans, they will always play through games, and whether it helps your chess or not is, you know, secondary in a sense.
Yeah, hard to say. So one of the questions we got, and we were prepared anyway to cover, is kind of, this is a classic question. So let's say you agree with our whys or your own whys on like, why do we bother to study full games and hopefully annotated games? The next question is when to study them. So I kind of put this straw man, you know, 800 or 1800,
right?
You know, like the very different ends of the spectrum. A lot of newer players are more close to 800. Lots of players who've been playing for many years, like myself, are closer to 1800. I know you're closer to 2200. But when did you first start really reading proper game collections, and what would you recommend to others?
Yeah. We've talked before, Neil. I think the first game collection book I might have read is Masters of the Chessboard, which I know you have read as well, by Richard Reddy, great player and author in his own right. And I'm guessing I was probably about 1400 by then. I don't think I was lower rated than that. As we get into the books that we will be discussing individually, there definitely are a few books that are suitable for players below that level. But certainly I think that by the, it becomes increasingly important as you climb up the rating scale to have some working knowledge of having studied some games.
Yeah, good points. I'll say I bought a lot of adults who have some money in their pockets. I bought way too many books when I started. I think I bought Dorofsky's Endgame Manual probably on day two. Right. So like I bought all the wrong books, but like I bought a ton of these kind of books like Logical Chess and Most Instructive Games, and they just sat on my shelf. I think I tried a couple times to knock through them, and what I found early days, so around my kind of 800 to 1200 days, I really didn't understand a lot. Even with Logical Chess move by move explaining every move, there were too many mysteries for me. I'm sure other people like will get a lot out of some of the kind of what I'll call my kind of basic game collection books earlier than I did. But I will say, I think a misnomer is, because I went through all of the ones we're going to talk about over 1700 rating USCF. I got a ton out of them, even Logical Chess, which is maybe the most basic of all of them, as a 1700 player. So I think that there's this view that there are books that are quote unquote too easy. I think that's almost impossible in chess to have. I mean, if you can't learn from master level play, then there's something wrong with you. And so I think that it's never too late to like pick up a game collection. And I would say, you know, better to start with the more basic stuff and work your way forward. Next question I wanted to talk a little bit about was, general approach, like reading full books, or do you do just the ones that are in your opening? I know when you've talked in the past about chess structures, Grandmaster Guide to Chess Structures, Rios's book, you've said like maybe one way to do it is to just look up those structures that you play. What are your thoughts on like going through every game, even if it's not in your opening repertoire, or should you focus on those that are kind of towards your opening?
Yeah, this is one of those cases where it becomes challenging, because obviously in a perfect world, you would just say, you know, give me all the games, but we've all got limited time to study. So we kind of have to make tough choices about what it is that we do study. So honestly, you know, this is another one where I don't know for sure. I can say a lot of it might come down to your goals. You know, if your goal is to maximize your improvement time, then you might want to select for your openings, especially if your near-term goals are, say, not super ambitious, because some people will say, you know, the old possibly canard, I don't know, you know, Andras Toth would certainly say it's true, is like if you learn the London, you might be limited in the structures that you know, stuff like that. So you might want to know a wide range of structures if you've got like a long-term plan and want to reach a certain level. But if you just are learning an opening and feel like you don't really know where the pieces go, then I can't really argue with you that if you want to learn the King's Indian, you look at a bunch of Kasparov or Fischer games in the King's Indian and not the rest of their games, because there's so many to choose from. So I think it comes down to personal preference in large degree. And if you're kind of just learning for enjoyment or want to learn about a particular player, then that's certainly a check in the column of just look at all their games. Or if you're reading a tournament book and want to get a sense of the tournament, then look at all the games from the tournament. But I hesitant to say that there's like a definitive right answer.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think there is. But I will say, so I'm a kind of a completist, so I tend to finish books I start. And so I've done a more general, and that was a conscious decision on my part. And one of the benefits, I will say, of looking at every game, regardless of opening, that I noticed in my recent tournament that I played in after years of break, I really felt at the board every single game, I really don't care what the middle game's going to be. I am going to have a plan. And in every middle game, I did have a plan. And it didn't matter which pawn structure it was, whether I knew the name, whether it's like a Benoni, or I don't even know all the names of all the chess pawn structures, but I just knew I had seen games in every single one of them. And so I think there's a confidence, much like studying the endings, mastering basic endings is like cheat codes towards the end of the game. I think knowing pawn structures and seeing enough complete games in all the pawn structures is like a cheat code in the middle game. It gives you a confidence. And I think chess is confidence is so important. It's psychology is, I think, more important than sometimes people give it credit. So I think that's a plug for being a generalist. But I know a lot of people who are super focused, like they only look at that openings and they only look at stuff in their openings, and they're probably gaining ratings faster than me. So there's a counter argument for sure.
Yeah. I mean, it's just really hard to say. And again, I think so much of it comes down to individual preference. So it's hard to just give like exact advice.
Yeah. And how do you study? I'll tell you, my approach is very simple. I've got a board that's about a 12 by 12 inch board. So it sits comfortably on my desk. I grab my book. I have my highlighter and my pencil. I play a move, and then I think about what the next move is going to be. I always set it up from the white side because the books tend to show from the white side. It's easier to double check that my position's correct. But I make a move. I think about what I think the next move might be. I then look and see if I'm right. I make some notes sometimes when I'm right and wrong as I'm going through the game. And so it's kind of a quick version of guess the move. I only spend about 30, maybe 40 5 minutes per game on average. And I do that because I'm going for volume, because I'm going for learning lots of patterns. Right now in my chess level, I think pattern recognition is critical. And so I'm not spending 3 hours a game. If I did, I would never finish any of these books. But that's kind of my approach. Are you like get the board out or just kind of read it and have it all in your head?
Yeah. So this is another one where it's changed over time. When I was a teenager, it was the analog age. I definitely had the book out. I had the chess set, you know, as has come up on the pod before. Some people even recommend having two sets so that like if you play through the moves and then when you reach a point where there's variations, you can have that the second board be like your variation board. I myself remember a lot of times trying to reconstruct positions when you looked at variations, but these days I'm strictly digital. I've mentioned many times, I love reading courses on Chessable. I like Forward Chess. New in Chess has an app. So I like these game viewers. And then even if I'm reading chess books on Kindle, which I often do, and of course, which do not have a game viewer feature, I'll often look for the game online, often chessgames.com. If you just Google the game, you can find it. You can then add it to a Lee Chess study and play through the moves. Or if you have Chessbase, which is another possibility for me, you can call up the game on Chessbase and play through it because it's just easier to play through variations. And Neil, I think we've talked about this before, but I think a lot of it comes down to your chess education. Because I had an analog education, I never worry that when I sit down to play an analog over the board game, that it's going to feel foreign. But I know that people who came up in the digital age, they often feel like if they don't study it with a physical board, then sitting down at the board for a real game can be too foreign. So I think a lot of it just comes down to your experience level.
Yeah, good point. I mean, one of the things I will say, because I've also read several books on kind of memory and brain function. One of the books I read recently talked about how if you can use multiple senses, your chance of long-term recall is better. And so that gave me some confidence because I'm reading, so I'm visualizing, I'm moving pieces, so I'm touching, and I'm writing notes. So there's like kind of three different ways I'm using my brain all at the same time. And so I do think that's going to make it stickier. My old brain needs as many hooks as I can get into it. So like, I think that's a plus for, physically touching pieces as you're going through a game is it might give you a better chance to retain some of those ideas. How do you think we should fit annotated game study into our regular kind of somebody has like 10 hours a week to do chess? Should they spend 3 hours, 3 minutes? I have some thoughts on this, but like, what are your thoughts on, and what do you do? What do you recommend?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I want to say that's an excellent point, Neil, about like different sensory inputs being an additional way to remember. And it comes down to just one of these many cases where, you know, can the perfect be the enemy of the good? Because I think you're pretty clearly right, you know? As I've mentioned many times, I have kids at home and often there's a lot of stuff going on in the house. So it's just hard for me to necessarily get out a chess set. But I think, all things being equal, it it's hard to imagine it's worse to have out a chess set, although I guess maybe it could be slightly less efficient. Now, sorry, Neil, I forgot what you had asked me because I wanted to add that point.
What percent of time do you put into game collection? What do you recommend?
Yeah. So again, I'm maybe it makes me a bad host, but I'm hesitant to really give recommendations. But I mean, my instinct is for it to be like a slow but steady part of your chess diet. But there's, again, especially with players who came up in you know, prior ages, like recent interviews I've done with Grandmaster Alexander Fishbein and Gregory Kaidanov, they talk about how much they love what they call solitaire chess, where they basically play through a game and guess the move, cover up the moves. So, I mean, obviously, they've had a lot of success considering that their main way of studying. And one thing, again, that strikes me is it's just very enjoyable. So I would say at least a little bit, at least 20%. And then, and again, this is more geared toward if you're, say, over 1500. If you're below 1500, we might talk about this more later, Neil. But I think the lower rated you are, the more your emphasis should be on studying your own games as opposed to studying games from books and games of the greats and stuff.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. It's in the beginning, it's much more important to kind of figure out what's going on in your own games, for sure. My you know, made up approach is the following. I'm spending, you know, a couple years going through game collections, and I'll have gone through about 2,400 unique games, because maybe 2,600 total, probably 200 duplicates, 2,400 games. Of those, I've been highlighting and making little stars in my books of the ones I think are the most. So I'm making Neil's most instructive games ever played list. It's going to be roughly around 300. And when I'm done with this list of, say, 2,400 unique games, and I'm moved on past strategy, I'm into end games, I just keep adding layers. So every morning I try to do, you know, a few tactics flashcards, a few positional flashcards. My plan, once I go on to focusing on end games, is to do two of these 300 a week to review them again. So that'll be like an hour out of, say, 10 or 15 hours a week. So I think that as a sustaining approach, doing one or two you know, master level annotated games a week would be good. And my goal, my own personal goal, is to just create a Lee chess study for all these 300. And each time I review them, find one more interesting thing that I hadn't noticed before and keep adding to my list of interesting things. So that's my kind of building strategy. So I've done tactics, strategy, next will be end games, and finally openings. And so I'm adding little layers of a little bit of daily or weekly work every one of those. And so a couple, my plan is to do two a week until I die. So what do you think of that approach?
Yeah, I think that's perfectly reasonable. It sounds good to me. And one other thing I wanted to mention is, like, there are also cases where you might be wanting to work on a specific aspect of your game. And in those cases, it can make sense to go deep on games, to spend a lot of your study time doing it. Like, obviously, if you're trying to learn positional play, you can study a Capablanca or a Carlsen. Or a Karpov. And if you're trying to learn tactical play, like I've mentioned before, my coach mentions, you know, I could do better at playing with the initiative, at keeping pressure on. So at some point, he recommended I play through Tal's games. So if you're trying to, like, you know, get inspiration from a specific player, then certainly this can be like the book you read. And rather than just doing a little bit a day, you kind of, you know, go all in on a certain book for a certain period of time. So, you know, but if nothing else, I think, as you say, Neil, I think it's good to have a bit of daily practice with it.
Yeah, so maybe one last category before we go on a break would be something you mentioned at the beginning, like, well, what can you expect? So, like, I don't know anyone else in my kind of level who's going to go through, you know, has gone through 1750 and going to go through 2400 total. Like, why did I bother? Did I get any benefit? Like, all those kinds of questions. And so I'll say two practical things that I've noticed in my games in general, and particularly in this tournament I played in. One was, like I said, I felt totally at ease that a plan would be clear to me, regardless of kind of how crazy the middle game went. And that was true in all of my recent tournament games, as well as in my kind of daily practice, whether they be kind of rapid or long format online games. The second thing that's more concrete that I have noticed in a few of my games in the last month, it's something I never used to do, which is sacrifice a pawn for positional reasons. In some cases, it's been to chuck a pawn to free up a bishop diagonal. In other cases, it's been to chuck a pawn to make room for a knight in enemy territory. These decisions I've made recently have been mostly intuitive, just looking at the position, saying like, almost like how Yasser talks about how like the position requires a sacrifice in order to like make progress. That's kind of in my brain what I was thinking. And in most of the cases, when I look at the game with a computer afterwards, the computer thought my pawn sacks were the best move in the position. So that gives me great confidence that I'm getting something out of these game collections. Anything else you want to add on that before we go on our first break?
No, I mean, I would reiterate that chess is, you know, at the end of the day, you're sitting down to play a game. So, you know, breaking the game down into fragments can only take you so far, because you will be, as you allude to, Neil, you will ultimately be confronted with problems that you're not confronted with by a tactics trainer or memorizing an opening. You know, there's a lot more to chess than that. So what we're going to do next, as Neil alluded to, is talk about specific books, because as Neil said, he's been working super hard. So he's read a bunch of them and ready to give you guys some notes about which ones are the most worthwhile. And I've read a good amount of the ones Neil will discuss as well. So we will be right back, and then we will get to them.
I've been playing a bit of Blitz lately, and whenever I'm active online, it's fun to go to aimchess.com and ask their almighty algorithm to give me some insights from my games. It scrapes the playing sites automatically and gives you actionable intel. In my case, the real takeaway this time was I got a 7% in resourcefulness in recent games. That's not very good. I need to get better at that. I need to fight harder when I'm losing in a Blitz game, look for tricks. And of course, Aim Chess, as it highlights various aspects of your game, strengths and weaknesses, shows you positions from the game so that you can practice, you can review tactics that you missed, and learn lots in a fun way when you review. So please check out aimchess.com. If you decide to subscribe, use the code perpetual30. You can also use the link in the show description to get the same discount, 30% off at aimchess.com.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
And we are back. And as we said, Neil did what we would call, I don't know about if beginner's the right term, but lower level segment of books, I would say more geared towards people rated below 1500 or so, and then a more intermediate. So should we start with the lower level books that you read, Neil?
Yes, and I'm actually still going through the intermediate, so there's still more fun to have there. But on the what I called kind of the basic game collections versus my intermediates, the first one I read was the first book of Morphe. I know you did a podcast on it. I really liked it a lot. It was my first game collection that I actually finished. It's only about 30 games, I think, so it's very manageable. I would not recommend like 200 Alekhine games as your first book, because you probably never finish that. But like something in that range of like, you know, Winning Chess Brilliancies, I think only has 12 in it. I think Logical Chess is around 33. So I started with Morphe, first book of Morphe. I know you had challenges with the way that the formatting was on the book. Excuse me. But generally, my sense was you feel pretty good about that book, right?
Yeah. I mean, as we talked about on the pod, and listeners can check it out if they want to hear the whole thing, but the TLDL is it's a very unique book in that it's
written about one of our great champions, but written kind of specifically with beginners in mind. And there just aren't that many books like that. And because Morphy played, you know, in the 1800s when we didn't know nearly as much as we did about chess as we do now, the matches were quite uneven, and he just has like a beautiful tactical style. So the games themselves really sparkle. And I think often with a good game collection, the best thing is going to be the games themselves. So it is an unfortunately imperfect book, but if you're rated say 1200 and thinking about reading your first game collection book, I think it's as good a choice as any.
Yeah. And then I did Logical Chess, which is kind of considered an anchor book for a lot of people. I really loved it, and I got a lot out of it. I think anyone under 2200, you could learn a lot from that book. It does get a little bit repetitive. You'll skip the like 30th time he talks about why E4 is such a great move, okay. But you know, it doesn't matter. Like, you'll just breeze through that stuff quickly. Masters of the Chessboard, I heard lots of people recommend it. I liked it as well. It's by Richard Reddy. I felt like of all of these basic books, it gave me the best sense of culture. It really kind of started with Steinitz and worked its way forward. I really got a sense of some of these, you know, great players. I frankly found Steinitz's games to be some of the most interesting. Like, I could understand them. And I got, like, imagine a world in which you know chess strategy and virtually everyone you play only knows tactics. That's kind of the world that Steinitz lived in. And so he would crush people because either they would not understand his like slow looking positional stuff, or they would just try to attack in dramatic fashion, and then their attack would fizzle out and then he would win because he's up a knight. And so like, it was really, I think Steinitz's games really are helpful for somebody under 2000, because that's how real chess is played. It's by people who generally don't know strategy and or people who were just throwing everything at the king. And so I found his games really interesting. It gave me a taste of all these players like Alekhine and Capablanca, who I'm going to read in more detail later. It wasn't my favorite, but I definitely feel like it scores like an A on the chess culture test. What was your thoughts on Masters of the Chessboard?
Yeah, I think I'm one of the people possibly guilty of recommending it. And it's one of those things where like why so many older generation players that I interview will recommend my system, because when I was a kid, it was one of the few books that was around, that was widely available and did take you through chess history. And I remember Steinitz in particular. There's a famous Steinitz Blackburn game, one of these closed Roy Lopez's, where he brings his knight to f1 and then e3 and then f5. And it's just very instructive in terms of how to quietly reorganize your pieces. But I think your criticisms are well-founded. I mean, generally any book that's as old as that one is going to have a hard time competing with newer books, although Logical Chess, of course, might be an exception in that regard. But I like it, but I think it's reasonable to prefer other ones.
Yeah, the next one I'll mention is Winning Chess Brilliancies by Yasser. Now, this was the last of the Winning Chess set that I had purchased. I purchased it just for this group. I'd read the rest of them. And I'm in general, generally speaking, I'm a huge fan of Winning Chess series, and Yasser in particular. I would say this was not the best of the series. I would tell people they could pass on this book. It's only 12 games, which if you don't want to do a lot, then there's something for that. But it's only 12 games. Several of them are Yasser games, which is fine. But I don't think they're necessarily the 12 best games ever done. I just felt like it was good, but not great. I don't know if I know you've looked at several of the Winning Chess ones. I feel like they're not all of equal kind of value. Are you in that camp too, or what's your thoughts on that one?
Yeah, that one I'm not so familiar with, so I can't really. I'll defer to you on that one, Neil.
Yeah, the last two that I read in this category really are, you know, ones that compare to each other. One is Chess, the Art of Logical Thinking. And it's frankly more of a logical chess move by move, follow up. It's by Neil MacDonald. I felt like Neil MacDonald's Chess, the Art of Logical Thinking, was better than Logical Chess. much like I think there are better books than My System Today or Pawn Power Today. But I will say the book that held up the best test of time is Chernev's Most Instructive Games of Chess Ever Played. And my method, in case anyone was curious of how I chose, like, how did, the most instructive games ever played beat the rest? At the front of every book, I would just make in pencil notes of how many games I felt like were some of the most, what are going to make my group of 300. And 31, it just works out to half, 31 of the 62 games I wrote at the front of the book are some of the best games I've ever seen from a instructional point of view. None of the other books I read had half of the games be kind of what I would call truly masterpieces. And so it's rare for me to see an older book that is better than all of these books that have obviously tried to come afterwards and replace it. It gives me hope to like keep reading older books from time to time, because just because it's old doesn't mean it's been replaced. So I know you're a pretty big fan of that one too, right, Ben?
Yeah, I am. It's a great book for, I think, anyone rated, say, 1800, maybe even 1800 or lower, maybe even higher. It's also a great book for teachers because, like Neil said, it's just got so many amazing games. And the fact that he explains basically every move and he's a good writer makes it quite worthwhile.
Cool. So I am just starting the intermediate books. I'm right now doing a two-book set on Alokin, however you want to say his name. I will say that like I was mesmerized by Morphy when I first went through his games. I feel like Alokin is like a better Morphy, and this might make all the chess people who know more about chess freak out. But I feel like Alokin would just crush Morphy. Like Morphy could do like a 5-move tactic. Alokin would do like 20-move tactics. It's insane where he says 15 moves later, this will be clear. You know, and he was right. Now that might be him after the fact making it sound better than it was during the game. But I'm really stunned. The biggest thing I've gotten from going through a bunch of Alokin's games is I personally believe, just from my own experience, that, you know, I'll say it this way. I've never lost or won a game, tournament game, because of like an 8-move combo. It doesn't happen kind of under the 2200 level, at least in my experience. It's usually like the 1-4 movers that get you in trouble. And I've beaten players rated over 2000 with kind of 4-5 move tactics, never more than that. And so I think a bias against feeling like people, particularly under 2200, should be trying to do these like 10-move calculation exercises. But I will say that these Alokin games have changed my perspective. Like if there was a person who was going to motivate me to take it up a notch, to go from like I can do a 5-6 move tactical sequence to like a 10-12 move tactical sequence, Alokin's the guy, because it's just incredible to me the creativity that he demonstrates. Again, to me, it's like Morphy on steroids. It's preternatural. It's really incredible how sharp he is and how creative he is. He's obviously all good strategically as well, and his notes show that, but I'm really stunned at how good of a player Alokin is. I've got Judith Polgar and others to come that I'm sure are better than what Alokin was, but it's really shocking to me how good of a player Alokin was. I never really studied his games in detail. You did some as a kid, right?
Yeah, and again, playing through some of his most famous games today, I mean, often with a player, if I'm just trying to refresh my memory or get acclimated to someone, I'll go to chessgames.com and they have a notable games thing right on the landing page for any given player. So I just looked at Alokin's, the 10 games that they have on his notable games, and it was a lot of memories being jogged of these like famous combinations and classic games that I had seen but didn't have sort of at the tip of my tongue in terms of remembering them. And a couple things to add, Neil, I mean, you're definitely not out on a limb saying he's like way stronger than Morphy. I mean, he was like, he was like steps above his predecessors, and there is sort of a clarity and an an energy in the way he plays that it's to my shame that I haven't read a proper Alekhine game collection, but in books like Masters of the Chessboard and, you know, all the various compilations of various players, I've certainly seen my share of his games. And yeah, unfortunately, he was not the best person, but there's a lot to learn from his chess.
Yeah, good point. I mean, next I'm going to do two of the other kind of classic older players, Capablanca's best games. There's a 100 game collection, and then Botvinnik's 100 selected games. You know, I think both of those will be great. So, lots of people on Twitter were telling me if I don't do Botvinnik, I'm missing out. So I'm excited about those. And then I'm doing more of a general one. This is a classic I've owned for years. I've never read it. John Nunn's Understanding Chess Move by Move. Have you done that one?
I haven't done it in full, but I have it and have looked at some of the games in it. And one other thing I wanted to add, this should go without saying, but of course we're talking about books, but you can still do a deep dive on a player in less analog ways. I mean, you know, obviously there are various YouTube rabbit holes. People like Agon Monter and Daniel King, you know, at times will do series on a given player. So you can just sort of, you know, grab the iPad and sit on the couch and watch a bunch of games that way. If you don't share my inability to pay attention to videos for a protracted period. And as I mentioned, there's, you know, if you have chess base, you can just look a player up. Some of the games are annotated, so you can even just select for the ones that are annotated. So you don't necessarily need to buy chess books. In fact, Neil, I noticed the Alekhine ones are beautiful McFarlane books, and beautiful McFarlane books also mean expensive McFarlane books, and they mean no ebook. So there's lots of ways to learn these players and learn from these players, and annotated games are just one way, although one that Neil and I are certainly partial to.
Yeah, great point. I mean, the last two players I'm going to go through, and I had to stop at some point. I mean, there's a lot of players I'm missing. I'm sure you would add ones. We can talk about that in a minute. But I got a two book set. Tibor Karoly, is that how you say it?
Yeah, I think so.
You know, he has two Making of a Champion in the prime years of Karpov. I was really blown away when I read the book that Karpov maybe was involved in called Find the Right Plan. Karpov's ability to play strategic chess, it was very foreign to me when I started my journey on chess strategy, and I just felt like he had incredible clarity that I wanted to learn from. So I'm excited to go through all of these Karpov games. And then my last set I'm going to do is the three book set, Judith Polgar's three book set. I'm excited to finish with those. Judith, obviously one of the strongest players to ever play the game. I think it'll be interesting for me to learn more about her history. I know her father also was a big fan of flashcards, so I feel an affinity there. I know that her sister is super engaged on Twitter, which I find really awesome. And you read the set. So what are your thoughts on this Judith set that I'm going to read a little bit?
Yeah, so I did a podcast with Jen Shahadi on the first of that trilogy, which is called How I Beat Fischer's Record. It's about when Judith was a kid. And as you will, anyone who heard that pod or hears that pod will hear, Jen and I just absolutely love those books. They're kind of a unique mix of, there's some full games, but there's also some game fragments. It's also one of these books that's like part memoir, part game collection, which, as someone who does like books with words in them, for me, that's like catnip. But I know for others, they might be more inclined to just want straight up games with annotations. But, you know, they're from Quality Chess, so they're beautiful books. So, yeah, and Judith, obviously, is she's sort of like the descendant of these famed attacking players, you know, your Kasparovs, your Talls, your Alekhines, your Morphys. So she's sort of next in line in terms of the way that she played. So two thumbs up. And of course, our boy Andras Toth did a course with Judith on Chessable that also is worth checking out, because I mean, she's drawing from her own games in either case. So, you know, and as is the case with a lot of these, like when you were talking about Karpov, the Karpov book that I have familiarity with is Sam Collins' Karpov Move by Move. And often there's going to be pros and cons about any sort of book that you pick. But if you're learning from that particular player, you kind of can't go wrong.
Sure. So, yeah, I'm doing 16 total between these basic and intermediate 16 books. That's obviously a super sub list Obviously, Fisher's 60 games is not on the list. Tal's life is not on the list. I'm sure people, my decision was to just wait on those till I'm a little more advanced. I feel like I will get more, particularly from Fisher, when I'm a little better player. But are there other books kind of for other players who are maybe 1800 or below that you think you would recommend that you've read?
I'm sure there are. I mean, there's so many game collection books, but I feel like we've given a good overview of the ones. I mean, I did want to mention, I just discussed Karpov's Move by Move. Everyman has a whole series of Move by Move books. I found them, some of them are good. They're a bit uneven. The other thing is I would warn that they're not Move by Move in the Chernev or even the Neil McDonald book you mentioned, which I also think is excellent. They're not Move by Move. They don't cover every move, even though they say they're Move by Move. But I think they are decent choices because, like, I enjoyed Junior Tez Ivanchuk Move by Move, even though, I mean, he's not a world champion, but obviously everyone loves Ivanchuk. So there's just so many. And again, I think it's more about define your objective. You know, do you want to know about a specific player? Are you trying to cultivate a certain style? Are you trying to just cover all the world champions? And once you've defined your objective, then you can kind of go from there in terms of which books to select.
Great. Did you want to do one more break here, or do you want to go to the next section?
You are a pro, Neil. Let's take one more break and we will be right back.
Perpetual Chess is proud to be brought to you in part by our presenting chess education sponsors, Chessable.com. Of course, Chessable uses spaced repetition to help you learn opening sequences, tactical patterns, specific end games, whatever it may be that you need to work on your game. Some of their latest courses include Understanding Chess Openings Part 3 by none other than Big Vladdy, former world champion, Grandmaster Vladimir Kramnik, sharing his lifetime of expertise on how to respond to various E4 possibilities. So be sure to check that out. And they have a free preview for Chessable Pro members. So please just remember to make it part of your routine to go to Chessable.com and check out all of their new offerings, which are available both for free and for purchase.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And we are back. And Neil, when he posted that we were going to be discussing this on Twitter, as we said, we got a lot of good questions. I was surprised. There was a lot of interest because I do think there's this sense that people are told that they should be studying games, but they don't necessarily know what to do. And as we said before, unfortunately, we don't really either. But nonetheless, we'll do our best to try to give some guidance. So which questions haven't we tackled yet, Neil?
Well, the one board or two board question we haven't tackled, this was from Chess and Maintenance on Twitter. I use one board, like that's plenty for me. I will say it's tied into another Twitter question. I don't go deep on these side variations. In fact, I'm avoiding books where the side variations are two-thirds of the book. I'm not trying to understand all of the grandmaster level thinking. I'm trying to understand how was the game played and what were the reasons. So what I do is, If I feel like a sideline is so important, I will just go down it with my pieces and then set the board back up the way it was before I went down the sideline. I would say 90% of the time, I just look at the moves. I do my best to visualize what's happening. I try to understand why they matter, and then I move on. Because I think I would spend 1 to 2 hours per game if I was really trying to look through every possible sideline. And I feel like that's just too much for me at my level. So have you ever tried two boards?
I have not. Yeah, I did. As I said, when I was reading a lot of books with a chess set, I did play through a lot of the variations. Obviously, another good thing you can do if you're ambitious is to try to visualize the variations. Really take your time. And when they, you know, when they give them, don't play them on the board, but try to picture them in your head, because obviously if you're playing an OTB game, that's somewhat replicating the experience. But yeah, I never did the two set thing. And you know, the older I get, unfortunately, the less I play through every variation.
Sure. Another question that, you know, came up, was, and this was by Bram, Kellens, was, you know, do you prefer, and I do think this is a preference thing, do you prefer a single player or collections? So examples of collections would be understanding chess move by move, logical chess, chess the art of logical thinking, and most instructive games ever played. So I will say, you know, probably in my top 10 ever chess books to date I've read would be most instructive games ever, games of chess ever played by Chernev. Having said that, I think it's the exception to the rule. My preference is to focus on a particular player, focus on Morphy, focus on Kappa, focus on Karpov, focus on Alekhine, et cetera. I feel like I get more of a rhythm of how, and get to understand how they think by looking at a lot of their games in a row. It is better for me if, it, and most of these books do this, they show both wins and losses. But I also prefer collections where the people are annotating their own games. So one question is, do you do a collection of different players, or do you do all of one kind, one player only? And then a secondary question is, if it's one player only, can you get it with their own annotations? That's obviously, in my opinion, better, but not always possible. So what are your thoughts on which do you prefer? Do you like to kind of mix it up, or do you prefer single player collections?
Yeah, I mean, certainly we've both recommended some books that kind of jump around and discuss other players or do profiles of individual players. But I'm with you, Neil. I've got a strong preference for collections from one player, because as you say, there's a flow to it. And towards the end, you do feel like it, like if you're playing Guess the Move, if you're doing solitaire chess, which, by the way, I've gotten a couple questions subsequent to the Fishbein and Kaidanov interviews about how to do solitaire chess on Lee Chess. And I do hope to make a video about it at some point soon. So make sure you're sub to our YouTube, the Perpetual Chess YouTube channel, which mostly is just audio renderings and the occasional video pod. But at some point I'm going to post a video about how to do solitaire chess there. But anyway, I mean, I really prefer just, you know, cause you start to feel them, you know, like if you play through a bunch of tall games, you know, you really do get a sense for his sort of like a gambler's approach to dynamic chess. And, whereas with Karpov, you know, you start to really appreciate that delicate touch. So there's just, yeah, it's really fun to just try to get in the head of a particular player and just kind of, you know, go deep on them.
That's awesome. So we've covered kind of my portion, and appreciate your thoughts too on the recent game collections. You've like read through dozens of books for your podcast on these book reviews. And so I know we wanted to give you a moment to say, you know, maybe not everyone's got as much commitment and time as you do, Ben, to read dozens of books. And so I wanted to give you a chance to really lead us in the next final section on kind of what would you say is your short list of the books that you've reviewed on the podcast?
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, not everyone even has time to listen to all these book review pods. I totally get it. And actually, our original plan for this podcast was, I'm now at 32 books have been reviewed. It hasn't been 32 episodes because a couple we double dipped, but 32 books have been reviewed in depth on this pod. Of course, obviously I've read a lot more chess books than that, but those are a decent guideline for like, maybe you just want to think about listening to a podcast, or at least like sort them for by genre. So obviously, since this has been predominantly based on game collections, I think I'll start with the game collection books that have been reviewed here on this pod. And as Neil said, there's always going to be some overlap between general improvement books and game collections, because a lot of general improvement books might be like centered around a theme, but nonetheless, the examples are games. But we tried to we settled on doing it ones that are really just collections of games. Like Yermolinsky's Road to Chess Improvement, I think, was the one that we found the hardest because it really is basically his games, but it's arranged. This is how I learned this. This is how I learned that. So we put that one in general improvement. So here are the game collections that have been reviewed here on this podcast. The Mammoth Book of the World's Greatest Chess Games, How I Beat Fischer's Record by Polgar, Logical Chess Move by Move, The Life and Games of Mikhail Tal, My 60 Most Memorable Games by Fischer, Fire on Board by Shirov, A First Book of Morphy, Nydorf's, and then Nate Solon and I did a dual Zurich 1953 one. Of course, those books get recommended a lot. Nydorf wrote one, and then the more famous one is, of course, by David Bronstein. And those are actually the order I rank them in. So the Mammoth Book of World's Greatest Chess Games, it's amazing. It's mainly just because it's like such an amazing compilation of games that that one's my favorite. Although that one, it's probably 1600 plus is around where you would want to read it. Same for How I Beat Fischer's Record. So if you're newer to chess, but do want to get your feet wet in some game collections, then as we said earlier, the ones that I would recommend the highest are First Book of Morphy as a first book of game collections, and Logical Chess Move by Move, which I consider a better book, but it's more advanced, although he is a great writer, so he does a good job explaining it. Neil, anything to add about that list of books?
Yeah, you've read many more than I have in this list. I do feel like I want to read the Mammoth Book simply based on that podcast you did. It sounds amazing.
Yeah, it's really fun. I mean, it's always a project of that scope where you're trying to pick the very best games. You're always going to have quibbles. And as Christopher Chabrie and I discussed, the no Morphy games is definitely a choice. We can understand, they explain how they came to it, but nonetheless, there's always going to be quibbles, but it's a great book and, pretty easy to read and cheap on Kindle, as we discussed. So then to get to other general categories from the books we discussed in the general improvement. So I broke this into two sort of rating sections, below 1600 and above 1600. And we should say with all these, I'm not ranking the podcast, obviously. I'm ranking the actual books. But the best, and I think, Neil, you'll agree with me on this, my highest recommendation to learn positional chess below 1600 is Simple Chess by Michael Steen. And then Reassess Your Chess is solid, although definitely a significant step down for me. Winning Chess Strategies by Yasser is solid. And then I guess I may have revealed some biases here because a lot more of the ones I did are above 1600. A few favorites are The Seven Deadly Chess Sins, Road to Chess Improvement, Under the Surface. If you've listened to a lot of these, you've heard me recommend them before, but maybe I'll draw up a Google Doc and try to summarize it all because there's a lot to remember. And also you can always hit me up on Twitter or send me an email if you are looking for a specific recommendation for a specific purpose.
And I agree with you. I think Simple Chess is one of the best strategy books ever written, and something that I'll probably gain from reading at different levels as I advance in my chess. So totally agree with you. That's a star.
Yeah. And then in the category of chess tactics and puzzles, there's only so much you can say about them on a podcast. But so the four that we put in that category were The Woodpecker Method, which Neil and I discussed a few years back, Rapid Chess Improvement, which was sort of the predecessor to Woodpecker Method, Chess Tactics from Scratch, which was fairly recent, a fairly recent podcast. And I know a lot of people, especially Jesse Cry from the Dojo, shout out to Jesse, he read it and started recommending it. So I know he's got a lot of people in the Dojo training program reading and I think enjoying Chess Tactics from Scratch. And then Think Like a Grandmaster, which is another of these old books that gets recommended a lot. But honestly, it wouldn't be my first choice. And yeah, out of those, I would recommend Chess Tactics from Scratch the highest. Woodpecker Method obviously was I would say revolutionary, except as Neil and I discussed, kind of piggybacked off of the worse book, but more innovative, more ahead of its time, Rapid Chess Improvement. But the idea of doing spaced repetition of tactics, I think, is the most important thing about Woodpecker Method rather than the tactics themselves. In fact, as I don't remember exactly what we said on the podcast, Neil, but as I sort of look back on it with more time, I feel like the levels are a bit spread out and the advanced puzzles are pretty hard. So I feel it's a big undertaking and you might be better off using the method they describe in Woodpecker Method with something a little more bite-sized depending on your level.
Yeah, I think that what's hard with the Woodpecker Method is it's like 10% method and 90% examples. And I think those examples are really spread out in difficulty. And so it's not realistic. It's either going to be too easy or too hard, one or the other, if you try to do all of them.
Yeah.
I think the process is brilliant. And frankly, what I would say is you can find De La Maza's short essay he did on rapid chess improvement online. It's like 4 pages and you get basically all the best parts of the book in those 4 pages from a method perspective. The concepts were, if you're too lazy to read 4 pages, tactics are the biggest differentiator below 2200, and you can get better at tactics, and spaced repetition is a big way to get there. I mean, Chessables built a business around this idea and has clearly shown a lot of success in doing so. So I want to read Chess Tactics from scratch. I haven't yet. And everything I've heard is it's a great intermediate level book. That's your sense?
Yeah, definitely. Especially the prose parts, the non-puzzles at the end. He just does a great job deconstructing tactics. And it's definitely the kind of book you can go back to more than once. So yeah, that would be my highest recommendation out of those 4 tactics books. And again, this is not talking about, obviously I've interviewed all these authors and some of them have written fantastic books. It's just, you know, that would be a larger project to sit there and try to think of every single book that's come up on the podcast and evaluate them. So these are just the ones I've done pods about. And the last category is chess history, which there are 5 books that I would say are firmly in that category. Bobby Fischer Goes to War, which is a Fischer memoir, biography. The World Champions I Knew by a grandmaster named Jenna Sosanko, who just sort of tells stories about the world champions he knew. Although that one's, it's really good. The guy's a beautiful writer, but it's a bit uneven. Bobby Fischer Goes to War is very good if you want to learn Fischer history. But of course, there's also Endgame by Frank Brady, which is equally good. Blindfold Chess, that's the history of blindfold chess. That one I would not recommend as highly unless that really sounds like something you're interested in. But it's kind of a dry history book, although certainly has its moments of interest. Timmins' The Longest Game, that was fairly recent, so some of you may have heard that review. Definitely an excellent primer on the Kasparov-Karpov matches, which obviously are huge in the annals of chess history. And then the highest recommendation is Korchnoi's memoir, Chess is My Life, just because he just had such a fascinating life, and it's pretty well written. And you know, from all the shenanigans with his famous match with Karpov and the longevity of his career, that one to me is the best. And all of these are good choices if you're just looking for something that doesn't have chess games in it, that you just want to maybe pick up and read for 15 minutes before you go to bed or something like that. But I recommend out of those 5, 4 out of 5 of them are all good. Bobby Fischer Goes to War, The World Champions I Knew, The Longest Game, and Korchnoi's Chess is My Life. But Blindfold Chess, I'd say, is not as easy a read. Have you read any of those, Neil?
I haven't, but I remember smiling during most of the podcast that you did on Korchnoi's Chess is My Life and thinking, I probably will never read this, but I'm so glad I listened to your podcast, because I felt like in an hour I got a good sense of the book. And that was really rewarding for me. So if any of you haven't heard that podcast, I highly recommend that one. And I'm sure it's a great book. But this has been so much fun, Ben. I hope people get some value out of thinking about doing annotated games, going through some of these other categories that you've recommended. And it's a real service you do to do these game podcasts.
Thank you. Thank you, Neil. And obviously, I really appreciate all of your efforts. I know you have a lot going on, but you always come so prepared, have your bullet points down, you know, help people a lot. So before we wrap up, Neil, I feel like we got to do a bonus couple minutes because people who follow you on Twitter will know that you've also just for I'm trying to not curse here so I don't have to put the little disclaimer on the thing. Just for amusement, you're learning coding because you're not doing enough with chess aside from your job and family responsibilities?
Yeah, I am. I'm trying to prepare to actually go forward with a master's in computer science. And I don't have an undergraduate degree in computer science. My undergraduate degree from Boston College was in marketing. But I took six... the last 3 years, I've taken six different tech courses. I'm just about to finish a course on Java. I'm learning Java, and the reason why I'm doing this is because I felt like in my career I wasn't challenging myself enough. And as a person who's the head of product at a software company, the more I understand how software works, the better I'll build products. And so it's not a requirement for my career, but I'm actually liking it. And so, you know, I was doing more like 2 hours a day on chess. I'm now doing more like one to maybe 1.5 hours a day. I'm doing 1 hour a day on learning how to code. I've done Python and HTML and CSS, and so Java and object-oriented programming is really interesting to me. And now I'm doing algorithms, which are just another level deeper. But I feel like, you know, I wrote on my Twitter, handle when I joined Twitter in 2017 that I'm a lifelong learner. And I felt like I'm not living up to that standard in all parts of my life. And so I'm really fascinated. And it, what it's proven to me is, you know, I'm 53. At any age, I believe people can pick up a new thing that's totally scary, and they can learn it and they can get good at it. And so it's been really rewarding for me to learn all these software languages and learn how to code and not be intimidated and scared and fail and strive and succeed and all the rest. So I would just say to anyone, if there's something you want to learn, it's never too late. You're never too old, and be patient and you're going to get better at it.
That's awesome, Neil. It's quite inspiring. You make me feel like a failure, but on a broader perspective, it's quite inspiring. And I hope to take that advice to heart and pick up some new skills myself. Keep it up, but just don't forget about us chess players. We need you in the We need you in the chess world too, Neil. So I think that's about it. In terms of the next book recap, I actually don't know. It won't be too long. It will be within 2 months, I would say, but I haven't lined up the next one yet. So I guess it will be a surprise. And then I have some more book content coming. FIDE Master Carsten Hansen, who's got to be one of the most knowledgeable people about chess books in the world, is going to do a podcast with me soon where we're going to name some underrated chess books. We will find some that were not discussed in this pod and talk about that. And then one book recap that will be happening in a few months is friend and returning guest and cognitive scientist Christopher Chabris and I will be going through a tournament book, San Luis 2005, very notable modern chess tournament that was played for the World Championship, which is an ambitious project. It's like 400 something pages. But wow. We'll also be talking more broadly about tournament game collections, which obviously Nate Solon and I did Zurich 1953, which gets name checked a lot. There's a few very famous chess tournament compilation books, but also someone like Jakob Augard of Quality Chess will tell you that those books don't sell very well. So a few months down the line, we will be discussing why they don't sell, you know, what role do they have in your sort of chess study, similar to what we've done here. But I'll try to have something else book related, one or two things book related before that, in addition to sort of your regular Tuesday interviews. Well, Neil, I think I've said my spiel. Anything to add before we say our goodbyes?
I'll just say, I know that it's a lot of work for you to do these book recaps. And they help me, and I think they help a lot of your listeners. So it's a lot of work for you. I'm sure it's more work for you to read these books than to just do a few hours of prep for a regular interview, but I'm grateful for them. I know a lot of your listeners are grateful. So just thank you for this.
Oh, thanks, Neil. Yeah, it is a lot of work, especially because it's like, you know, it's like the concept of like needing to master something in order to teach it. Like in order to be able to go on a pod and talk about a book for an hour, it's different. Even though whenever I interview someone and they have a new book out, I always make sure I read their books. But still, it's not like I'm just spouting off about it for an hour nonstop. You know, they're the ones who've spent their life writing this thing, and they're the ones that I'm just trying to guide the conversation. Whereas here, I'm actually trying to sort of synthesize. So yeah, they're a lot of work, and that's why I might be slowing down on them a little bit, but certainly no plans of quitting. And your help is always appreciated as well, Neil.
Well, thanks so much for having me, and I hope everyone enjoyed the show.
Okay, take care, everyone. We will catch you all in another episode soon. Goodbye from myself and from the Habit Grandmaster.
Thanks to everyone who helps make Perpetual Chess possible. Big shout out to my producer, Matthew Passy. I'd also like to thank the Blue Wire Podcast Network, with whom we are proud to be affiliated. Be sure to follow us on social media, Beneficial1 on Twitter, at Perpetual Chess on Instagram, or you can join the Perpetual Chess Facebook group. You can email me, ben@perpetualchesspod.com. And of course, last but not least, I'd like to give major thanks to the Perpetual Chess Patreon and PayPal supporters. Those who choose to join that community based on their level of support can do things like submit questions for guests of the show, have access to live Zoom Q&A lectures with grandmasters who often have appeared on the show, going over chess games, answering questions, stuff like that. And you can even get access to ad-free Perpetual Chess if that's your preference. So, but most of all, thanks to everyone for listening, and we will catch you all on the next one.
Podcast Network.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.